And may it please the Court. Your Honors, may I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal time?
Sure. Manage your own time.
The District Court erred in denying Mr. Sandoval's motion to dismiss for an invalid deportation in very important ways. First, the District Court erroneously found that Mr. Sandoval's conviction under California Penal Code 289A1 constituted an aggravated felony. Second, the District Court erroneously determined that Mr. Sandoval was not deprived of meaningful judicial review in his deportation proceeding. And third, the District Court erroneously determined that Mr. Sandoval did not have a fundamentally unfair deportation proceeding.
Does the case turn entirely on whether or not this was a violent offense, the underlying conviction?
Yes.
Because if it was, then his prior deportation proceeding, no matter how it was handled, would have resulted in his deportation.
Certainly, Your Honor. So the crux of the matter certainly is whether or not the conviction satisfies the definition for a crime of violence under 8 U.S.C. 16b, which requires essentially that there is a substantial risk of the use of force. Now, Mr. Sandoval, at the time, a 33-year-old man entered the country or attempted to enter the country using a legal permanent resident card that was originally issued to him, however, was invalid because of the revocation of his status. At the time, he had, and presently, he has family in the country that are U.S. citizens. His three children are U.S. citizens, his mother and father are U.S. citizens, as well as his siblings. Now, when Mr. Sandoval was placed in deportation proceedings on May 24th, 2010, the notice to appear alleged essentially two bases for deportation. First, he has sustained two crimes of moral turpitude, both being one of forgery, two being a grand theft. However, neither of those two crimes were aggravated felonies. The second basis was that Mr. Sandoval was an aggravated felon for having the conviction that we just spoke about. Now, Penal Code 289A1 is overly broad. Essentially, it criminalizes sexual penetration by a couple different ways: by force, violence, duress, menace, or fear of unlawful bodily touching. Now, the issue here is the duress part of this, because duress can be accomplished in a variety of ways that simply do not implicate either force or substantial risk of force.
Well, I understand the first part of your contention, that you can exercise duress without threatening force. But if you've got a non-consenting victim who's being penetrated with some object, isn't there always a substantial risk of violence in a situation like that? If the person stops being passive, isn't it quite likely that there's going to be a risk of violence?
Yeah, I think that the rationale really, perhaps Valencia and Gonzalez, I think, can be applied, although the statute there was different. I think the idea that the court has said here is that the touchstone really of the 16b analysis, it's not simply really lack of consent, it's really lack of actual consent. And this is where I think the duress, I think, is a little bit different, Your Honors. Here, a person may actually consent. Now, albeit the consent is determined to be legally invalid.
Okay. Because somebody has made a threat of some sort. Somebody has said, if you don't do this, something else will happen. And something else might not involve violence. It might be blackmail. It might be might be extortion or something like that. But I guess my question's a little different. If you have a victim who's consenting, quote unquote, under those circumstances, isn't there always a substantial risk that the victim will stop consenting and that violence will ensue?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that there's no longer a substantial risk. Is it plausible, and may there be some risk? I would agree with you and say yes. But a substantial risk, Your Honor, I would say no, because I think the actual consent actually, I think, really removes the likelihood of the need for a use of force, Your Honor. And so while, in fact, it's possible, Your Honor, but the substantial risk, Your Honor, I believe, is really vitiated because of the actual consent. Now,
do you have a California case in which that a duress theory was sustained under circumstances that you think fit the overly broad categorization? Do you understand what I mean? In other words, not that describes the statute and the circumstances that you're positing today where someone has consented under duress. Do you have a case?
Your Honors, actually I do not, and that's simply because I'm not prepared in that regard. I did not look for one, and
right.
So that's my shortcoming, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So I do not, but I would simply note, though, that You know, duress is one of, I believe, five ways in which this can occur. And consider duress where it may be economic, where a person says, I will fire you if you do not have sex with me. As that horrid as that is, it simply does not either involve or really even implicate the risk of substantial risk of force.
Are you suggesting that the court should have performed a categorical, a modified categorical analysis in this case?
I'm certainly suggesting that, Your Honor.
Do we know anything about the facts of your client's conviction?
We do not know anything by judicially noticeable documents, Your Honor. For example, at the district court level, we had documents including the abstract of judgment. We have the charging document. The charging document merely tracked the language of the statute, and so here the language is overly broad. So that does not help the analysis. The plea colloquy did not help the analysis. And so essentially, Your Honor, we have no facts that really demonstrate the actual underlying conduct. Now, one thing that's at issue here, and I'll bring up to the court, is during the deportation proceeding, Mr. Sandoval requested actually relief from deportation, and they also talked about the incident. And Mr. Sandoval indicated that it was a domestic violence situation that got out of hand. Now, it did come up at the district court proceeding exactly what that meant and if that provided a factual basis for determining that it was an aggravated felony. And the district judge actually agreed with Mr. Sandoval that it did not. And the reason for that is, Your Honor, when he simply said it was a domestic violence situation that got out of hand, it really was unclear. He's saying, one, that essentially he was trying to resolve the matter, you know, legally in terms of plea, domestic violence, then got out of hand and resulted in this PC-289 conviction, if it was just a domestic violence situation, but they never actually spoke about, and importantly, the immigration judge simply did not ask him what occurred, what were the underlying facts that occurred. And I would submit, Your Honors, that had the immigration judge simply looked at the statute instead of simply perhaps going off his best guess, he would have saw very clearly that one of the methods that this crime can be committed by is duress does not involve force. So in addition, Your Honors, because Mr. Sandoval was a legal permanent resident, then that also should have provoked some thought in the immigration judge's mind, because as a legal permanent resident, then there are potentially avenues of relief that's available. There's cancellation, there's a waiver of deportability, and there's voluntary removal, although I would suggest that that was perhaps very unlikely. But in terms of the other two bases, the cancellation of removal, Mr. Sandoval could make a plausible showing. One, he had been in the country legally, admitted as a permanent resident for more than 7 years. He had entered as a permanent resident or been admitted on August 28, 92, and he had been deported on May 24, 2010. So the 7-year continuous residency was established. Additionally, he resided continuously in the U.S., and at that point, he did not have aggravated felony status if this court determines, in fact, that this current conviction that we're talking about is not an aggravated felony. He also had waiver of excludability available to him. He has family that could have adjusted his status, his parents, his children, although they were minors, and there was extreme hardship. Now, I know that financial hardship is not sufficient alone for waiver of excludability. However, there was extreme hardship that I presented to the district court concerning the children, in terms of the children being emotionally depressed, acting out in school, their grades in terms of declaration being submitted by the mother. And so I made a record that, in fact, there was extreme hardship placed on the three boys, I believe they're perhaps 14, maybe 11, and 3 or so. And
so you could answer that under a minute if you wanted to reserve.
I would yield, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
I will note you didn't address the last issue with regard to the reasonableness of the sentence either.
You want to submit on the brief?
I'll submit on the briefing there, Your Honor.
Good morning. Victor White for the United States. Judge Hurwitz asked if this case really does hinge on whether or not the 289 conviction is a crime of violence, in which case there would be no prejudice to the appellant. And that is the case here. As the district court found after substantial briefing and multiple rounds of argument, 289 carries a substantial risk that force will be used in the commission of that crime.
Do you think that economic coercion, economic duress, could be a factor in terms of a violation of the statute?
It could be a factor, and more so with regard to the 16A, the element test of the crime of violence. But with regard to a risk analysis where we're dealing with probabilities, as with burglary, which is what this court has looked at with the Lisby case, you're looking at basically the risk of violent confrontation. So even in economic duress, there's always the possibility that the victim may decide, I'm not going to go through with this.
And the statute talks of physical force. Statute defines violence as physical force. So is it your position that by its nature, even if the consent is unlawfully obtained through duress, if you will, that there's a risk of physical force being used in these types of crimes?
Absolutely. We're not dealing with
the California case.
The California case that we point to is with the fact that the consent could be withdrawn, and as long as that's communicated at any point in time.
Right. I was wanting to get a California case on duress and consent of the hypothetical that we're positing today.
Well, the Espinoza-Morales case does look at the duress situation, but that's with regard to, again, the element. They're looking
That's a purely categorical analysis, and it's under the sentencing guidelines, not under the statute.
Under the sentencing guidelines, but also what would be under 18 United States Code Section 16A, which is the one that requires basically an element, the use of physical force. Whereas we're dealing with 16B, where we're dealing with, again, a risk analysis of probabilities, where the crime, by its nature, involves a substantial risk that physical force against the person or property of another may be used in the course of committing this offense. And that's why, really, the Lisby case is the case that's on point. And the Lisby case is the one that involved sexual battery. So in that case, we're dealing with an intimate touching of a victim who's unlawfully restrained, and it's occurring against the victim's will. So if in that case it was sufficient to qualify as a crime of violence under 16B, certainly here where we're dealing with a sexual penetration that's against the victim's will and that's being accomplished in one of five manners, which could involve force, violence, duress, or threat or menace of violence, it would qualify. Because, again, we're dealing with the probabilistic analysis, and like with a burglary situation, there's always the risk of violent confrontation, even in the situation of economic duress.
Was the, just to refresh my recollection, was the deportation in this case based solely on this conviction?
It was based on this conviction as well as two crimes involving moral turpitude.
But those are not, you don't urge those as a basis for the ultimate fairness of the deportation proceeding?
No. We urge that the crime was categorically a crime of violence under the risk analysis of 16B. There's a substantial risk of the use of force, as well as the fact that here the appellant made a concession at the pleading stage that this wasn't the sort of economic duress situation that's hypothesized at this point in time.
Well, but that would be a modified categorical analysis, wouldn't it? In other words, that would be, I'm focusing on the actual events of this crime. And I read the district court finding, it's really a categorical analysis that notwithstanding the elements, this kind of crime always fits within 16B, no matter what happened. Is that a fair
statement? That's a fair statement, Your Honor. And we're arguing in the alternative, if this court...
Okay, what document are you talking about if we get to the modified categorical approach?
To the modified categorical, I'm referring to the colloquy between the immigration judge and the appellant on excerpt of record 48. And I'm arguing under Perez Mejia, which I cite in the brief, and which this court, as well as Pagayan, where this court looks at basically admissions that are made at the pleading stage. And here, the immigration judge, page 48 of excerpt of record, immigration says, then they say what on August 26, 2003, you were convicted in Los Angeles County for the crime of unlawful penetration of genital area or anal area in violation of California Penal Code Section 289A1. Next page, excerpt of record 49. Is that true, Mr. Sandoval? It was supposed to be a domestic violence that I tried to fight, but it got out of control, Your Honor. Yeah, that's true. And then the immigration judge goes on to ask if he concedes later on at that page, line 18, and also because you have been convicted for a crime of violence for which you received for a sentence of a year or more. That's the sexual penetration. Do you agree? Yes, Your Honor.
Well, okay. Before that, he says the government says you should be deported.
Correct. But
so he's agreeing with that the government says he should be deported. I don't know if he's admitting
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I guess my difficulty is that as I read the district court record, I don't know that the district judge found that on the facts of the case it was a crime of violence, but rather he agreed with your 16B argument. Isn't that a fair summary of what happened below?
That's a fair summary, Your Honor.
You're just arguing the alternative here in case we were inclined not to find it a categorical offense, right?
Absolutely. I've learned.
I think in that event we'd probably have to send it back to the district court for its analysis, although we do have the record in front of us.
And that's what I would urge this court. If this court wanted to make the analysis, here is the colloquy between the immigration judge and the defendant. But I do
urge. Just stop here for a second. There's nothing else in the record. This is what you have. That's the best evidence in support of the modified categorical approach, right?
That's correct. As appellant points out, the judicially noticeable document, as far as the charging record and the plea colloquy, don't narrow it to knock out duress, since the charging document contained duress and all the other ways that it could be accomplished. But I would urge this court again to apply Lisby to this case and to look at this as the probabilistic analysis that it is, as it is in the context of the armed career criminal, where we're looking at a very similar sort of risk analysis, and it has been found in the Terrell case that a sexual assault carries, again, a risk of the use of violence, in that case physical injury. And unless there are any questions.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Your Honor, just briefly, the government relies heavily on Lisby. Lisby is completely inapplicable, and I'll tell you why. It is not on point. Lisby, in that case, the particular statute at issue was PC 243.4A, and that sexual battery required as an element under restraint. So under restraint, that's the physical piece of this that definitely is lacking here. So when the government suggests it's on point, it's definitely not on point, because the whole issue here is that duress does not involve any type of physical component. In addition, Your Honor, the government relies heavily on the court. The district court, in fact, relied heavily on cases under the Armed Career Criminals Act, the ACC. There, the analysis is different. This court, you know, has said that just because a case perhaps is a violent felony for purposes of the ACC, meaning that there's a substantial risk of physical injury, not all cases or all statutes that involve a substantial risk of physical injury also involve a substantial risk of the use of force. And so those statutes are different, and so the meaning of violent crime under ACC or crime of violence under 16B are distinguishable and different in a significant way. Finally, Your Honor, Perez Mejia, that the government wants to rely on in terms of at the deportation stage, completely different. In Perez Mejia, this court found it significant that the deportee, he was represented by counsel, that in the notice to appear, it specifically stated a factual basis that there was cocaine involved in terms of a specific drug. And then at the deportation hearing, the attorney made a tactical decision to not fight the sufficiency of the evidence, but instead to later try to appeal. And so that case is very distinguishable here. And the attorney at the deportation phase actually admitted or conceded the factual basis for that crime. This is very different, Your Honor.
What do you make of the argument of under the modified categorical approach that the confession of domestic violence takes this case out of the duress situation?
Because it wasn't confession of domestic violence in terms of a legal sense. What you have is here, you have an individual that simply says that this was a domestic violence situation that got out of hand. And
right. So you have domestic and violence. Why doesn't that indicate that there was certainly a risk of of injury in this case?
You know, there are two different things, Your Honor. One, the way that he may be using in the common sense, you know, for the common
way.
The common layman point of view is simply it could have been, an argument that got heated, got out of control. It could have been that he was trying to resolve this by way of domestic violence without regard to whatever the underlying facts were instead of resolving it by way of PC-289A. So in terms of him actually admitting facts, he didn't admit any facts at all.
I think my question was, and I realize we're dealing on this appeal with the categorical versus the modified categorical approach, but we have taken a look at the modified categorical approach in a couple of cases. But I guess my question is, why doesn't his confession or his statement take it out of the duress situation that you're urging us? I mean, it's certainly not a classic economic duress. He's saying it was a domestic violence situation that got out of hand.
Well, but he's not saying, Your Honor, there, and I would urge the court to not to add meaning that necessarily that the act itself, the incident that occurred, the behavior was domestic violence. He very easily, and the district court agreed in terms of not being able to interpret that, may have simply been saying that he was attempting to resolve the matter, resolve this incident without talking about the underlying facts, resolve it legally by way of domestic violence, but it got out of hand, and then he had the PC-289 conviction. So the simple fact is, Your Honor, that we really don't know what he meant, and the district court agreed with the appellant that it couldn't glean any meaning from that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you.
You know, I had a question for the government that I just couldn't pull up while he was standing there.
All right.
Yeah, quick. I'm just curious. You know, the district court in this case looked at this, I don't know how to pronounce it, but the Osmancevic case.
The district court did, Your Honor. And
found it persuasive, and no one has mentioned it today. So I understand it was mem dispo, but it was found persuasive.
I understand. And if I could just mention one thing. In that case, the court did find that California does list 289A1 as a violent felony. And that was one of the things that in the district court's written decision, the district court did note in finding it persuasive. And the fact that, again, it Osmancevic does cite Lisby, again, for the proposition that this is the sort of offense where there's inherently a substantial risk that force would be used.
Okay. You want to address that case just briefly?
Yes, Your Honor. Simply, I think that case was unpublished, I think, wisely, because, in fact, it relied heavily on Lisby, but I would submit, Your Honor, erroneously, because Lisby, again, requires a constraint. And so in terms of the duress component, it does not require a constraint or any physical force.
Okay.
And so those are very distinguishable.
Very good. Anything further? Okay. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted for decision.